this is Myra Gurney. This is the third lecture in the Principles of Professional Communication series, and the title of the lecture is Nonverbal Communication, More Than Just Words. Over the last few weeks, we've looked at various models which sought to examine and define communication from a variety of perspectives. In week one, we looked at the Shannon and Weaver model, which is the most famous attempt to clarify and explain communication in terms of its components and as a form of linear communication of a message. Remember that two of the definitions put forward were of communication as the ordered transfer of meaning, and secondly, the process by which messages are sent and received. The emphasis in both of these definitions is on the elements of the sending and the receiving. The other definitions that we put forward included that communication could be considered as the reciprocal creation of meaning and the sharing of information, ideas and attitudes between or among people. Both of these examples, or these definitions of models, see communication as a transaction between people, where meaning is constantly being negotiated and recreated. Last week we discussed the impact of the perceptual processes on the creation of meaning in order to demonstrate that one person will not necessarily derive exactly the same meaning from a communication transaction as was intended by the person sending the message. The mental set or the frame of reference of the parties involved in the transmission or the transaction must be taken into account when framing the message. The topic of today's lecture relates to an aspect of the communication process that can alternatively enhance or detract from the conscious intention of a message, the conscious intention of the person sending the message. It's that part of the message which is not spoken, but which does not involve language. Therefore, even though writing, for example, is not actually spoken, it is still considered verbal communication because of its use of words to communicate, even if they are on paper. However, even writing has non-verbal aspects, as the presentation and layout of a piece of written work can non-verbally communicate to the reader. So therefore, what we're going to look at today are some of a range of aspects of what is really a very, very large topic, and we're going to look at non-verbal communication. Okay, so what is it? In 1981, a famous study by Kendon defined it as ways in which communication is affected between persons when in each other's presence, other than with words. Alternatively, and in a reading that's in your workbook, Fleur, 1993, defines nonverbal communication as the deliberate or unintentional use of objects, actions, sounds, time, or space so as to arouse meaning in others. Now, the thing that is similar about those two definitions is that they both recognise that nonverbal communication can be both deliberate and not deliberate, or unconscious or subconscious, and that it doesn't necessarily have to be merely gestures or things like that. It can involve things such as objects. It can involve things such as time and space. So it isn't just what people do with their arms or their voice or their eyes. There are a whole range of other issues which come under the banner of nonverbal communication. Now, the thing that we need to remember is that it's very difficult to make a neat distinction between verbal and nonverbal messages, because as the transaction models illustrate, people don't just use one mode or another, but constantly shift back and forth. One supports the other, one enhances the other. Sometimes they complement, sometimes they contradict. Okay, if we have a look at the slide 3 in the cartoon there, why is nonverbal communication important? Is because a myriad of aspects that of issues that you do with your body, your voice, etc., what you wear, have an effect on the person to whom you are speaking, on the listener of your message. So, as the slide says, what you wear, how you stand, your facial expressions, your tone of voice, all have an effect on the listener. So how much of communication is nonverbal? According to Mark Knapp in 1980, he's another well-known researcher in this field, the average person actually speaks words for a total of only 10 to 11 minutes daily. The standard spoken sentence takes up to about 2.5 seconds, and in a normal two-person conversation, the verbal components of that message, i.e. the elements that are important, that have an impact on the message, carry less than 35% of the social meaning of the situation. So what does that mean? Much of what we communicate, therefore both intentionally or unintentionally or subconsciously, is therefore communicated non-verbally. And while the focus of our culture is generally speaking upon spoken and written language as the dominant communication media, studies have shown that we don't always trust these totally to derive meaning. The message it received is equally, if not more, affected by what we would probably label intuitions or feelings, which allow us to derive additional messages than those that are being outwardly or consciously communicated. What these feelings and intuitions in fact are based upon are our reading of various nonverbal signals which are either deliberately or unintentionally accompanying the message of the person who is speaking or people interacting within a particular situation. The study that's most often quoted in respect to nonverbal communication is a famous one from 1981 done by UCLA researcher Dr. Albert Mehrabian. And he claims in his research that the influence of nonverbal messages on meaning, on what people understood, was as follows. He said that in face-to-face communication, 55% of the message that was reportedly derived by those involved in his research project came from the person's body language. 38% came from their tone of voice, and interestingly, only 7% from the words that they actually used. He also measured the amount of nonverbal communication that was relevant to a message when there was no physical body presence, via a telephone, for example. In that, he said that 82% of the message was derived from the person's tone of voice, or maybe their pitch or their inflection or how loudly they spoke, and 18% from what they said. Now, that's a really important and a very interesting slide. Okay, now there are a whole range of different areas of nonverbal communication. As I said, we do tend to automatically equate it with body language because that's what people talk about. But there are a range of other factors which are equally as important. Okay, so it can be conveyed through. All right, so just let's begin with the notion of body motion. Now, that's normally what we refer to as body language. In academic terms, that's referred to as kinesics. Okay, and that includes things like posture, gestures, eye behaviour, facial expressions. And we're going to talk about some of these in more detail a little bit later on. Nonverbal communication can also be communicated through vocal qualities, the way that people speak, and that's called paralanguage. Now, qualities of the voice can include the pitch, the rhythm, the tempo, that is how fast you speak, the volume, the resonance. So people who have deep voices, James Earl Jones, who was the narrator from the Lion King, for example, famous American actor, has a very deep baritone voice, comes across as being, you know, quite authoritative and that sort of thing. He quite often played those sorts of parts in the movies. People who have sort of high-pitched, squeaky voices, generally speaking, are not perceived as being terribly authoritative, or in some ways even, you know, if they're men, terribly masculine. Unfortunately for people like Michael Jackson and maybe David Beckham, the famous English footballer, their physical presence and their vocal qualities don't match up. Nonverbal communication can be communicated through touching behaviour, and that generally, or haptics, that's called, and that generally includes things like greeting gestures. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Things like hitting, stroking, guiding, so, you know, putting your hand behind someone's back to guide them into a car, etc. It can be communicated by the use of space, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this. There's a famous article in The Reader by anthropologist Edward Hall, who studied this, and that use of space is called proxemics. So the way that people use personal space to communicate a whole range of attitudes, feelings, behaviour, cultural norms. And that's a very interesting study. Nonverbal communication also includes the use of time, or chromatics. Okay, our perceptions of time, and how, if you keep, in Western society, if you keep someone waiting for a long time, it's generally perceived as being rude. In other cultures, as Hall writes, that's not necessarily the case. It can be by the choice and use of artifacts. So, you know, the fact that we choose particular brand name clothes, Rolex watches, Ferrari cars, BMWs, etc. We choose to wear the labels of our clothing on the outside. What that does is enable us to non-verbally say something about our status, maybe how much money we have, maybe what kind of a group we belong to, something about our personality perhaps. And lastly, we can also, in our homes, our offices, etc., our cars, again, we can communicate something about ourselves, our personality, etc., by the characteristics of the design of our physical environment. So the type of furniture that you have, architectural style, the use of colour, the kind of colours that you wear, music, decor, all those sorts of things. Now we'll look at each in many of these in more detail with another range of examples a little bit later. Okay. Now some of the modes of nonverbal communication include a lot of these factors. So let's think about, for example, firstly, eye contact. Okay, now, they say that the eyes are the windows to the soul, and eye contact is one of the most powerful nonverbal signals, particularly in Western culture. And in Western culture, eye avoidance is usually construed to mean shiftiness or dishonesty or an unwillingness to communicate. Now, that I say Western culture because we do need to make that cultural distinction. It isn't the same meaning in other cultures. In Western cultures, when we say, oh, I couldn't catch their eye, when we are describing an inability to catch a person's attention, those who are unwilling to communicate, such as students in a classroom, children with their parents perhaps, who don't wish to be asked a question, will deliberately look away. The intensity of a gaze between people is usually used as a signal of the nature or the desired nature of a relationship. So people with whom we feel comfortable will tend to keep a longer gaze. People that we wish to communicate with will perhaps stare at more intently. From a fleeting glance at the person in the car next to you at traffic lights to an amorous gaze at someone to whom a person is sexually attracted, the length of time we hold a gaze will be different according to the nature of the relationship with the person and the communication context in which that gaze takes place. Someone wishing to be dominant or aggressive, for example, will attempt to stare the person down. So think of the language. The language reflects these particular concerns. Or someone who is embarrassed will deliberately look away. As I said, the meaning given to eye contact is very much culturally determined. In many cultures, for example in Japan and other Asian cultures, it's considered rude to look someone in the eye, especially if they are your superior in status or maybe in age, and so juniors are taught to lower their eyes in the presence of elders or of people of the opposite sex as a sign of respect. Facial expressions, on the other hand, are really interesting, and they allow us to read information about emotions of the person with whom we're communicating via the various positions of muscles on the human face. It's been estimated that the human face is capable of creating more than 250,000 different expressions, and these expressions are subtle indicators of the state of our emotions. Now, I've got an interesting reading in this year's workbook about this by a study by a researcher called Paul Ekman, and you can perhaps discuss that in your tutorial. And it's a very interesting article about the importance of the human face in communicating. If we can't have expression because of different neurological problems, do we lose our ability to communicate? And that's the research project that Ekman is talking about. Of course, not all of us read expression as well as others, and it's been suggested that women, for example, are much more attuned to the nuances of facial expressions than are men. The use of the so-called poker face in negotiations is perhaps indicative of the ability of most people to mask their emotions behind a blank expression. And of course, we're all taught the importance of the impact of a smile in social encounters and in business as a means of getting people to like you and, importantly, to trust you. Now, touching is another one of those incredibly interesting areas, and like eye contact, is also governed by very, very strict social rules and cultural codes. The degree of touching acceptable in any group varies according to age, social situation, and cultural background. So therefore, what's acceptable or not acceptable is very much culturally determined. So we need to take those parameters into account when we're judging whether people are doing the right thing or not. Parents convey their feelings towards their offspring with hugs and kisses, and psychologists suggest that the lack of touching from significant others in childhood can seriously impair a child's emotional and psychological development. And in fact, most primary emotions of love and hatred are conveyed through touch. Now, the important thing to remember about touch in Western society is that, as I said, it is a matter of strict rules and can signify the nature of the relationship between people. Between those who are closely associated, touching is both accepted and expected, but between strangers, it's not encouraged. Difficulty over what constitutes sexual harassment, for example, in the workplace, partly arises from a misunderstanding of what constitutes acceptable touching behaviour. And while touching, therefore, is a powerful channel of communication, it is the one which carries the most social and cultural taboos. So therefore, if we have a look at slide 6, for example, you might like the Larson cartoon there, the squid family on vacation. Okay, but most greeting gestures, for example, involve various forms of touching, and we'll have a look at some of those in a moment. Okay, all right, but in general, touching of same-sex friends is confined to the shoulders and the arms and the hands. Okay, and generally speaking, how close a relationship is when we're shaking hands or we're hugging or whatever can be seen by either a second hand on the arm or shoulder, etc., in a handshake. Okay. Other interesting facts about touching behaviour is that in Western cultures, men are reluctant to touch or be touched by other males. And if you compare this to, say, some European cultures or Middle Eastern cultures, for example, greeting gestures include hugging and kissing between men. And the frequency with which people touch is generally a reliable indicator of their perceived power. So the more powerful the person is, the more likely that person is to be the toucher, as opposed to the person being touched. Now, if we come back to greeting gestures, as I said, traditionally in the West, handshaking is the accepted form of greeting. Most of us have had the experience with people with a wet fish handshake, that is a weak, limp type of handshake, or a knuckle grinder. And those people are either perceived as weak or potentially domineering. As I said, greeting gestures differ widely from culture to culture. Many European cultures, men kiss each other on each cheek. If we compare that with a lot of indigenous cultures, such as the Maoris and the Tibetans, they poke out their tongues. Polynesian and Eskimos or Inuit rub noses. Nigerians clench fists, and this one might interest some of the blokes. Some tribes in New Guinea, they clutch each other's testicles. Now, our effectiveness as communicators will depend upon our awareness of and our response to those kinds of cues. Now let's have a look at some examples of, in Western cultures, of handshake and greeting gestures. Okay, so in these kinds of rituals, your relationship with the other person will determine how close you stand when shaking hands and whether you use one hand or two. Now these slides come from a book by Alan Peace called Body Language, which is quite famous. A little bit old now, 1981, but it's still, you know, that they make interesting observation. Example that I gave before, that in Western cultures, handshakes are an important form of greeting. So, but not all handshakes communicate the same thing. Okay, so there's some examples there. All right, and what happens if we get it wrong? And you can see from the Larson cartoon, Gary Larson's always very good at picking up on these non-verbal and cross-cultural communication scenarios. And as in the cartoon, inadvertently Roy dooms the entire Earth to annihilation when, in an attempt to be friendly, he seizes their leader by the head and shakes vigorously. Okay. All right, now I mentioned the other aspect of nonverbal communication, which is paralanguage, and that's just another way of saying vocal qualities. And essentially that term, paralanguage, refers to the meaning which is derived from speech and means beyond language. So para, the prefix para, means beyond. So therefore this term refers to the aspects of vocal sounds which are non-verbal or wordless, so not so much the words themselves but the way the words are delivered. It refers to aspects of vocal sounds. It includes loudness, pitch, articulation, pronunciation, pauses, and even the use of silence. So how we use our voice in this way can be as influential to the meaning of the words that we actually articulate. When people say, "I heard what you said, but I don't believe you," what they are reacting to is not what you've said, but the way in which you said it, the way that you delivered the words. And this particular aspect of nonverbal communication is extremely important in speech making and things like selling, and of course in interpersonal relationships. Where the words that are used conflict with the nonverbal signals that the speaker is emitting, it is the nonverbal message that will be believed. So in paralanguage, tone refers to the feeling or the emotion. Inflection refers to the emphasis on words and syllables. So if I said to someone, "Oh, get out," or "get out," and I put the inflection on the "out," there's a totally different meaning, even though I'm using the same words. The pitch refers to how deep or how high a voice sounds, and that the example I gave was, say, you know, Michael Jackson, this sort of Mickey Mouse kind of a voice versus James Earl Jones. The rate, how quickly people speak. People, when they're nervous, tend to speak very quickly. And again, that can be an indication of nervousness or being unsure, etc. And the volume is how loud or how soft a voice sounds. The study of the next one that I want to speak about is the study of spatial communication, or what Edward Hall referred to as proxemics. And it's an important factor in the communication of human relationships. Hall maintained that we segment our lives into zones of increasing intimacy. And if you, for example, watch how people behave when they're in a lift, in an elevator, compared to how they behave in a crowded bus, when they're forced to be within the same physical space as others, what do they actually do? And the lift example is always interesting, because people will generally stand with their backs to the lift and look at the buttons, look at the floor. They won't look at the person who's standing next to them. They usually will keep their hands close to their bodies and try as much as possible not to touch the person next to them. But interestingly, the thing that Hall determined is that this perception of space is very much culturally determined. So it's highly culturally specific. It's argued, as Hall has done, that those races or those ethnic groups that live in crowded, confined cities have a much smaller sense of personal space than those who live in countries where there's a lot more physical space. Now, you could even make the distinction within Australia between people who live in urban areas, so therefore, you know, we're used to living closer together, our houses are closer together, we're used to walking on crowded footpaths, etc., compared to people who live in rural areas in Australia, where, you know, the blocks of land are larger, people live a lot further away, and there's much more space available. Now, how we use space to communicate status and social relationships is also very, very interesting. And you can see from the slide here, the slide comes from Alan Peace, but it is actually based on Hall's research. Those in important positions communicate their status non-verbally by, for example, the size of their office, the size of their desk and their chair, and where people are asked to sit or to stand in relation to the person whose room it's in, they're in. So are they asked to sit on the other side of a desk, a large desk? Are they asked to stand away from the desk? So people, students being chastised by the principal will generally be asked to stand up away from the desk while the principal sits behind their desk. They have the power, in other words. Standing out there on your own, away from any kind of a barrier, is intimidating, and it's intended to be. A size of a person's house, for example, will communicate something about the wealth or the status of the occupant. Now, this is a very Western perception again. And offices and apartments on the top floor of a building are generally considered much more prestigious than those on lower levels, and generally speaking, cost a lot more as well. Now, if we look at the zone distances that Hall drew up, he said that, and again, this is based on Western perceptions, the intimate zone is between 15 and 14 centimetres from the body. The personal zone, between 46 and 1.2 metres, 46 centimetres and 1.2 metres. The social zone, between 1.2 and 3.6 metres, and over that, there is the public zone. Now, how do we use that? If we look at these slides, next slide on slide 14, next pictures on slide 14, you can see that often when you, in Australia, when you watch men, rural and urban men, shake hands, there is a difference in the distance between which they stand from each other when they shake hands. in this particular, in slide 15, in the next example, I've titled it Too Close for Comfort. All right, what indicators are there, for example, that the woman may feel uncomfortable? Have a look at that. Okay, I can hear people up the back saying, all right, she's leaning backwards, for example, so he's sort of leaning forward. She's raising her coffee mug, perhaps, as a potential barrier. All right, so he's a bit too close for comfort. Okay, the final one that I want to talk about today, and there are others, and we'll, you know, we can talk about them more in class, is kinesics or body positioning. And body postures are a fairly reliable indicator of the perceived self-confidence or otherwise of a person. And we're fairly intuitive in picking these up, even though we may not consciously be aware of how we're reading these. Think of crossed arms, crossed legs, leaning towards someone when talking or listening. All of these actions communicate your attitude towards the other person as well as to yourself, your attitude towards yourself. In other words, if you're shy, if you lack self-esteem or confidence, you'll tend to look down, you'll tend to cross your arms, you'll tend to perhaps turn your body away from the person to whom you're speaking. Open body cues, like the open palm gestures, etc., communicate a willingness to communicate, while other bodily positions may communicate defensiveness or inaccessibility. Now, I've got a range of examples of that. The important thing, many gestures, for example, such as nervous scratching, so, you know, scratching your nose, pulling your ears, pulling your clothes, adjusting your the sleeves of your shirt, etc. What are referred to as hand-to-face movements, so scratching the inside of the top of your lip, can be interpreted as indicators of lying or nervousness. Children, for example, who haven't learnt how to hide these things often cover their mouths when they are telling a lie. But as we grow older, we usually tone this down to hand-to-mouth gestures, which are generally quite subtle. But the important thing about it is that body language needs to be interpreted in the context in which it occurs. So if someone's crossing their arms, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're defensive. It could mean, if the air conditioning's too high, that they're cold. And in clusters. And by clusters, I mean what else is happening there. For example, if someone's crossing their arms, they might also be crossing their legs. They also might be looking down to the ground. Now, those three examples may add up to defensiveness, anger, aggression, nervousness, whatever, whereas just one on their own may not necessarily mean that sort of thing. But the important thing about them is that we need to be conscious of what we do, particularly in interpersonal relationships, in job interviews, in meetings, in negotiation situations, for example. We need to be conscious of how these things may be read in order to avoid sending the wrong message. All right, there's a range of examples here. Slide 17. Okay, I talked about arm positions. Different hand and arm positions communicate different messages. So if we look at these three guys, they're all holding their arms in different ways. One of them has a thumb up, and the caption is a superior attitude. The defensive attitude is indicated in this one here by the fists. So he's got his arms crossed, but there, you know, he's got his hands clenched as a fist. This fellow is trying to be casual. All right, so he's sort of holding hands with himself, and the one over here is a firm stand. Now that's sort of also indicated by the fact that he's kind of looking down. He has a fairly serious look in his eye. If we look at some examples from the newspapers, and a good exercise to do is to collect some of these for your portfolio and maybe do an analysis of what's actually being done here. Now, for those who are familiar with Australian Idol, the judge Ian Dixon, in Dicko Dixon, all right, you might want to, you know, interpret what he's done there. In other words, we need to have a look at how these things all fit together. Okay, so what's the relationship, in other words, between verbal and non-verbal messages? Okay, so let's have a look at some examples firstly, all right, some examples of body language in action. All right, in slide 19, okay, what are the indicators that the man on the right is left out? How does he feel? All right, I can hear some of you answering. He's got crossed arms, maybe a signal of frustration and displeasure. His feet are pointing away from the other two. Their feet are pointing towards each other. Their legs are crossed towards each other, signalling their attention. Okay, what about these two blokes? All right, the caption says thinking alike. How do we know that? Okay, and the answer is that they are mirroring each other's positions, indicating that they agree with each other. And what, generally speaking, when people go for job interviews, it's recommended that you watch what the interviewer is doing and you mirror what they do. And the reason for that is people look and they think, oh, there's something about you that I like. They're not quite sure necessarily what it is. All right, finally, the relationship between non-verbal and spoken messages, according to Mark Knapp, is that they modify or change spoken words in a variety of ways. Okay. All right. So, firstly, reinforcing or complimenting. So, an example of that is when somebody said, "How big was that fish?" It was this big. We can use nonverbal cues to contradict. So, if someone said, "Are you coming?" and say, "I hope so," and, you know, either to symbolise lying or wish fulfilment, crossing your fingers, "I hope so." Regulating or repeating, and that's where you give hand gestures or you put a stop hand to stop someone else from talking. And substituting, so rather than saying "I agree with you," head nodding or that sort of thing, "aha," as well as that sort of thing. Each of these aids and enhances our interpretation of the messages that we are receiving. And each aspect uses various senses that we talked about, sight, sound, touch, smell, etc., to enable us to decode or to interpret a message. Okay. Now, finally, another research paper done by Ross in 1991, and this comes from your textbook, suggests that the impressions that we make in any interpersonal communication context can be defined by what he refers to as the four image dimensions. And those dimensions are credibility, likability, interpersonal attractiveness, and dominance. And while all or any of these, according to Ross, may be important in any context, different dimensions are important or influential in particular contexts. So he gives the example of likability, and likability is, as I've got there, important in social situations or where people work together in groups. And that particular dimension may be more important where one's sincerity or trustworthiness are valued. So, for example, somebody who works in a customer service role, someone giving advice, etc. All right, their likability, the non-verbal aspects which relate to their likability, may enhance the fact that people are going to believe them, etc., and more likely to perhaps buy the products or to take their advice. Credibility is important where one's sincerity and competence are important. Interpersonal attractiveness is the third one, and that's about being interesting, emotionally expressive, and sociable. And dominance is about power and assertiveness. So perhaps in a leadership or a management role, the dimension of dominance would be important to getting the job done, to getting people to follow, to keep people in line. Now, Moen, in where this particular information comes from, the textbook gives a range of examples of how we can attempt to manipulate our nonverbal behaviours to create favourable impressions, especially in business type situations like job interviews. Okay. All right, so while we can all be tempted to analyse various body signals for meaning, we must remember that on their own they can be misleading. Someone crossing their arms, as I said before, may do so without necessarily being defensive. No one gesture or facial expression should be read in isolation and should be only taken into account in the context of the communication situation and the person who is communicating. And the relationship between verbal and non-verbal factors must be considered, as well as the impact of culture. So, as I said, a light, limp handshake, for example, in some cultures is not the indicator of weakness that it is perceived to be in Australia, for example. So, therefore, the total message, both verbal and non-verbal, and the extent to which they are congruent is the key to deriving the meaning in most communication situations. Now, this, of course, is a huge topic. I've only been able to give a very, very brief overview. I recommend that if you're interested in it, that you do further research and do further reading. There's a lot of things written about nonverbal communication, and there's quite a number of articles in the list of references. It's also useful, as I've said, as an exercise, to try and apply some of these perspectives by looking at newspaper photographs, as I've done. So have a look at some of these examples and think about what cues are present. All right, so I'll just show them to you. All right, you can analyse this quite, happily write quite a lot about each of these. So, of course, Leighton Hewitt, Australian tennis player, often uses the come on, the hand on the heart. All right. I've titled this Aboriginal Reconciliation at Work. Have a look at the way these guys are sitting, slouching, arms crossed, compared to the way that John Howard, Prime Minister John Howard, is sitting. All right, politicians at work, okay, a hard day serving their political masters. All right, facial expressions. Amanda Vanstone there, the immigration minister. Okay, the good and the bad news, all right. Johnny Wilkinson, the hero of the English Rugby World Cup. And of course, Anthony Mundine, looking very belligerent there. Many faces of Steve Waugh, Australian cricket captain, for those who are interested in cricket. And, of course, the hands up, etc., a scene from the Gulf War. Okay, right, the next lecture will be next week on censorship, and I look forward to seeing you then.